Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Joseph.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. The last time we dealt with the unfortunate question of this very strange or eccentric upcoming trial for me. And here we are a week later, and there's been no formal recitation of charges. There's been no description of any warnings where this could have been changed. No one is returning my phone calls or emails. I have received no procedural instructions, rules of evidence, what counts as evidence, who these bishops are, what their qualifications are, whether or not they have conflicts of interest or anything else. So it's already a complete farce, just a design to humiliate and to attack. This obviously is not how these kinds of things go in any way, shape, matter, or form. I'm not going to belabor this. It's really not worth it, but it shows you that this was never serious. It wasn't taken seriously by the people who promoted it. And not even the basic procedural questions. What we would call in America discovery have even been broached with me whatsoever. So anyway, today we're going to talk about something very different than this. There are two people who, when I go to the new martyrs, the neo-martyrs of the Soviet yoke, that I go to first and foremost, Valentin Vintitsky and Andrei Vulfa. These two are eccentric for a few reasons. Number one, they were both Christian socialists and Christian anarchists to a great extent. Number two, especially Andrei, was deep into the Old Believer movement. And he was in the Old Believer movement for the same reason that I've always been sympathetic to them, that they have, in their parish structure and diocesan structure, they imitate the true concept of church government. The communal idea was about a pravna, subornost, and how things should be run. And the bishop is not a very important person. He's one of many. He has a very specific job, but it's the parish communities that matter. They balance each other out. And the only thing that really matters is that they have a shared commitment to the faith, to basic equality amongst members, a strong communal presence that's withstood persecution for many centuries. And that this, in St. Andre's mind, is absolutely essential in understanding the liturgy. The liturgy is this commonality, this common connection. This is why I've been harping recently the definitions of words are so significant. But these two are spoken of quite a bit, understood very rarely, and a lot of people don't understand how these two can be, you know, socialists of a sort. You know, when I say socialist, I'm not referring to Marxists or materialists. Most socialist ideas were idealistic and religious up until the point where Marx took it over. And the anarchist streak is a reaction to how St. Petersburg and Moscow after Peter I had completely distorted in church government. Something that I'll say over and over again, and both of these saints and writers agree with me on this, is that for Russian nationalists the world over, generally speaking, that Petrian era is a big black spot. If the ecumenists or new calendarists, if they are outside the church, then certainly Peter Synod is. If the Moscow Patriarchate, for various reasons, has no grace of the sacraments, then most certainly the Petrine Synod did. And we've been through this at different times over the last few years. But there's nothing that the Bolsheviks did later on that Peter the Great didn't do. And this is essential to understanding both these writers and understanding the reaction of many of the new martyrs, who they weren't so much coming up with a new ecclesiology, but relative to Russia in 1900, 1930, it was revolutionary. There is justice to the claim that the synodal system was a complete disaster. It was a perversion. It obsessed about the external structure of the church and stopped at that. It's the only reality worth speaking of. One of the things that the new martyrs almost without fail spoke of is that the Moscow Patriarchate, Sergius and Alexis, his successors, and the problem is that they only spoke about the canonical external coding of everything. The content didn't matter. And in a way, you can go through their acts and say not a single canon was violated, and yet, of course, they're involved in spreading atheism and trying to destroy the faith from within. But the Petrine Synod was the first to stretch this, to make this claim, to stretch this over the entire empire. Now, it's often said that this was a college of sorts overseen by an appointee, a procurator who was at least the financial overseer of the church. What's less well known is that most of these bureaucrats were secular or worse. Now, the way that Russian Orthodox Church always understood monarchy, it is primarily a religious institution. So when Peter the First became a Mason in Amsterdam, he was no longer a Russian monarch, nor could he be. And worse, when he made that poor slave girl, serf girl, Catherine the First, this was a way to mock the church. It was a way to imitate the, or what the French revolutionaries will later imitate as putting the whore of Babylon on the seat of the patriarch, the monarch, the seat of the patriarchy, now taken by a female whore. Although in the case of this Catherine, it was certainly not her fault. She was a serf girl, abused sexually beyond human reason. And because Peter's first wife was, I guess, boring and pious, and Catherine had no moral code whatsoever, she was sent into exile and sent to prison, and this woman was brought in. And it was a way to mock the crown. It was a way to mock the church. Peter was a Satanist. Very clearly, in his mock drunken synod, he called it. He even composed hymns, and they would go marching through the streets, dressed in black, urinating and vomiting. These are clergy and singing these demonic hymns to Pan and Bacchus. This was done, and churches were attacked. By the time Peter died, every single see in the empire had been sacked, purged, and the bishop forcibly retired. And someone else appointed for political reasons, many of whom were of the Masonic order, either by membership or at least ideology. And the only real concern was they are to venerate Peter. Theophan Prokopovich was a materialist. He believed in a very early doctrine of evolutionism. He held orthodoxy in utter contempt, and he is the first overseer of the church within this system. The new martyr, the Petrine yoke, have yet to be officially recognized. And my opinion is that they really can't be without kind of destroying the very simplified narrative that I had in the Third Rome, for example, in that book. I did say that there was a breach there, but now I say that breach is far more radical. And not only by the grace of God was any kind of canonical order, whether it be in the state or the church, restored in the 19th century, and there only very, very poorly. All the great saints of the Russian church in the 19th century were persecuted by the synod. The notion here, though, is that this is what Peter did to the church. It grew the Old Believer movement where it was larger than the state church. And Peter's open worship of Pan and of Bacchus and these nude, mocking, black-robed processions were proof that, you know, simply the grace had left the throne, and therefore Peter could never be a true monarch. Prokopovich was a secular man. He didn't, you know, obey the fast. He executed his enemies on a regular basis. Peter tortured his own son to death personally. I mean, these are possessed people. They can't be legitimate monarchs. And these bishops that were appointed for political reasons, if Sergius's bishops are invalid, then so are they. There is not a shred of canonical legitimacy in the 18th century in Russia. Again, it doesn't mean that it's all invalid. That's too mechanistic of a view. We don't venerate the external shell of things. Bishops are just as prone to error and as struggling as we are. But I mentioned that. I mentioned it before. I'll mention it again. Talk about this complete, you know, this is a massive breach and a massive interruption in Russian history and Russian church. The old believers, for the most part, probably were the only functional, workable church unit. When St. Arsen Matyevich went to Rostov to take his see, just as Catherine II is being enthroned, there were no Orthodox left. There was nothing. There were no functioning churches or monasteries. The cathedral had been boarded up, and no one really knew anything about the faith. It was a complete disaster. That's how bad the purges and the persecutions became. Peter, of course, this so-called Catherine, and, of course, Lord Byron, and the rule of German Masons over the country. And one of the things that happened is that these connection between the monarch and the people were severed. This is why the Slavophiles were correct. And in Treatments of the Slavophiles, Peter's extreme self-described revolutionary demonism and possession is not mentioned. It wasn't that Peter's movement was revolutionary. He said it was revolutionary. He said, this is what I'm going to do. He hated all things Russian. He hated all things Orthodox. Hetman Mazepa was correct. He was absolutely correct. He saw what happened to those around Peter. He knew that Peter didn't care, had no respect for human life, or the church, or dignity of any kind. He was killing people, torturing his own wife. Why would he spare someone like Mazepa? And someone like Carl in Sweden was the perfect substitute. And I would have done the same had I not known how it was going to turn out. Now that Peter executed people through some gruesome ways, breaking bishops on a rack. I don't know if you know what breaking someone on a rack is, but taking bishops and monks and torturing them while his drunken sobor would sing hymns. I mean, this is what was going on in Moscow and when he moved the capital. And in moving the capital, he slaughtered thousands of Cossacks representing not only the old believer tradition, but the old Russian Kievan tradition, and building a city on their bones. That's a Gnostic ritual. It's not an accident that St. Petersburg is floating, so to speak, on this completely, almost uninhabitable, swamp, frozen wasteland in the far north. It was a ritual where technology will dominate the order of God and creation. That's why Pushkin's Bronze Horseman is so significant. Now, I go through all of this, not only because it's a big deal for me and an essential idea in understanding Russian history, but both St. Valentin and St. Andrew have this as absolutely essential to their theology and understanding of history. They go farther than the Slavophiles in the sense that they say that this has infected all of Russia. It wasn't just an institutional schism. It wasn't just something that showed the old believers to be the correct ones, despite all their problems. But it infected the Russian psyche, that the adoption of this kind of bureaucratic model, that the worship of the external coding, the force rather than the content, became unfortunately something that infected Russian people, especially Russian elites, from there on in. It changed Russia entirely. Peter the Great, his successors, with the exception of Elizabeth and Catherine II, were part of a demonic assault on Russia, no different than the Bolshevik. The point being unlike a lot of the new martyrs, Valentin and Andrew, when the monarchy fell and the church came under persecution, he said, "It doesn't surprise me." They both said this very clearly. They are too associated with this bureaucratic mode of living. Bureaucracy is not government. Bureaucracy is not monarchy. Bureaucracy is only administration. It has no ideology. It may have a mentality. But when historians today are confusing the bureaucracy and their policies with the crown and believe that this makes any sense, I mean, it shows you how bad things have gotten. There's no connection between the two. Old Russia was centralized. Muscovy was prosperous. And there was no real bureaucracy. The various sobor came and met and organized themselves. This was a rudimentary idea, and yet the nation continued to grow and develop as a single unit. St. Valentin and St. Andrew Vufa take this bureaucratization as not just a spiritual idea, religious idea, but also as a political idea. Say, this is what fell in 1917. It's not to say that, or 1918, it's not to say that they supported any of this. Although for a while, Valentin supported like a lot of the old believers, a kind of a unitary assembly, like what the White Armies had been advocating. And that the crown was now too associated with Petersburg. And hence this non-Christian, Gnostic experiment of Peter the Great. And all the ingredients of these, you know, even Pushkin said as much, even Gogol, if you know the short story V. The demon shows up in a Ukrainian church that has been boarded up. That's not an accident. I know I've said this before, but it's absolutely essential. The church have been, about three quarters of the monasteries have been shut down. The Manyavsky in Austria-Hungary, Ukrainians, this was a place for refugees from Russia to go. Russian royalists and Orthodox people have to tackle this. If Sergius is schismatic, then so are they. If the Soviet government was demonic and godless, then so is Petrine and Katharinian. You can't have it both ways. And until that gets taken care of, it's going to be a contradiction. And so far, it has not been dealt with. You know, Ivan Solonovich and people like that, Anthony Klapovitsky, I mean, they condemned the synodal system. Philaret of Moscow, even. You know, they had absolutely no respect for that system. They saw its destructive nature. But understanding these two new martyrs and a lot of even the Optina ideal, for example, only makes sense when you put it against the background of what was happening, starting from Peter all the way to the revolution itself. This is what fell in 1918. This is the background. Andre and Valentin don't make sense unless this is understood. The Russian monarchy as such didn't really fall. It was a bureaucratic monster in Petersburg. Now, it's true the bureaucratic monster was not very big. It wasn't nearly as large as the urban prefecture in Paris, for example. Most of what the monarch did was police the elites of the capital, which was a full-time job in and of itself. This is what fell, though. Someone like Andre may say that really it fell in when Peter took over. Peter solidified the new right. I never blamed Alexis for this or even Nikon for this. Peter is the culprit. Alexis may have set things in motion. He brought in a lot of Westerners and began changing things, which in and of itself is not a horrible thing. But when it when the worst of that Westernization came in at the expense of the peasantry, then there's another matter entirely. There's nothing wrong with priesthood and Western theology. There's nothing wrong with the St. Peter in Kiev adopting scholastic methods. He simply did that because his opponents were doing that, and he had to write in Latin and face them on his own terms. There's nothing wrong with this. I mean, there are many great saints of the other Russian church took that approach. Remember, it was St. Peter Movila's catechism that was used throughout the 19th century in Russia. And seminary lectures were in Latin, not in Greek, not in Slavonic. So it had penetrated very deeply. Peter is the one who gave it fangs. Peter is the one who went into an open purge of all Russia, where you couldn't wear traditional Russian dress in any of the classier parts of his new city, Petersburg. Now, so when they're cheering the fall of the system, they're not cheering the fall of the Russian monarchy or of Orthodoxy. They're not cheering the rise of the Masons in either Kerensky or in Trotsky. They're cheering the demise of the Petrine regime. And it was this realization that brings Andrei to the Old Believers, and before I even read Andrei, me to the Old Believers. No, I'm not an Old Believer. You know, I admire them from a distance, because I don't know if anyone could stand for that long, or church services that are that long. I could never do it, but I admire them from a distance. But this is what proved them correct. You know, Nikon and Alexis were extremely mild. You know, their entire reign is 1 or 2 days in the Petrine system. You know, removing the capital was a way to get it away from the relics and the tradition of old Muscovy. That's the whole point of it. It was to make it a European city, that is to say, a secular Masonic city based on the grid system. The whole concept of the grid system is that it doesn't follow the topography of the place. It is above nature, doesn't work with it. This is the mentality that fell in 1918. So sometimes you'll find people who don't know what they're talking about. They'll be condemning these, you know, St. Valentin and St. Andre, saying that they you know, they love the provisional government and everything else, not realizing that it's a bit more complicated than that. The old Muscovite monarchy did not fall in 1918, it fell in 1700. It's true the 19th century monarchs, to a great extent, Alexander III and Nicholas II, did try a rearguard action. And God, in his mercy, always gave the church the grace that it needed. Good priests and good bishops are automatically given the faculties necessary to save souls. You know, we do not worship the canons, you know, or the external coding of things. But having belabored that point, the issue is, what is going to replace this? How do you bring the concept of old Moscow and the old Russian Orthodox idea, now that it's been strongly developed by the old believers, revolutionary situation, how do we bring this to Russia? Revolutionary situation, it was up in the air at the time. Both Kerensky, then the Civil War, and even the Bolsheviks. Most people didn't believe that the Bolsheviks would last very long. Most people believed that the system was so irrational, so based on a tiny stratum of urban Jews, that it couldn't possibly last. Not realizing that the West was pouring in food aid and weapons and ammunition to the Red Armies. Making sure that if this is the ideology that's going to take over, this will be the ideology that will dominate the East, hopefully dependent on Britain and America to control Germany, and to a great extent to control Russia. This wasn't Russia. The Soviet Union and Russia are opponents. It's like trying to connect modern Washington, D.C. with the Anti-Federalists. Yeah, well, it all took place on American soil. I mean, that's pretty much the only thing they have in common. For them, the revolutionary idea opened up a way to restore. And initially, it was seen as something wiping away the revolutionary idea. The Petrine state was a revolutionary state. It was a secular state. It was an Enlightenment state. It was never strong enough to be tyrannical. That's ridiculous. Bureaucracy was never that big. But and it was very successful in many ways. But when compared to Kiev or early Moscow, it's an absolute shadow of what... I'm choosing my terms deliberately here, a shadow of the old mentality. So, St. Valentin, bureaucracy is what destroyed the faith. Bureaucracy is more than just institutions and offices and stamps and paperwork. Bureaucracy is a concept of standardization in general. The idea that words and phrases completely exhaust the meaning of something. This is the essential concept behind apophatic theology versus cataphatic theology, that words are highly limited and can even be distorted. It's this intuitive connection with the church, with grace, tiny pieces of which can be put into words. Ritual, actually, and ritual actions do much better than simple words stated in an expository way. Like we spoke of with the Puglia several weeks ago, the concept of love shows up again and again and again. Love, light, energy, grace, this interconnectedness is more or less one and the same thing. Don't, you know, we use the word love, it's terrible how it's been so distorted in modern America and elsewhere. That's not what it originally meant. It was this deep sense of interdependency that as an individual, isolated, we're absolutely meaningless. Only in community where each has its place and each given equal dignity to the sense that each place, each function is essential to the running of the system and therefore should be treated equally. That has more to do with the old concept of love and faithfulness than our modern sacrament idea. Mankind, as all the great theologians of the past have said, is constantly degenerating. I have always rejected the view of evolution in really any form, only because devolution is so obvious. Things aren't getting better, more rational, they're getting worse. Like it or not, the neo-Darwinian idea is teleological and moral, whether they want to handle that or not. It is. Efficiency, the economy of movement, these things are essential in the Darwinian concept. But remember, we use these concepts, whether it be, I don't care, scientific or theological, always apply them in a broad sense. So you talk about Chalcedon, for example, human nature and divine nature. We're not just talking about abstractions. Human nature refers to everything that human cultures need to function. So it would include language and everything else. This is what we mean. The liberal arts, the way that humanity has freely interacted with each other and with nature, how humanity has defined itself, so to speak. That's what we're talking about with Christ's human nature, for example, among other things. So these aren't abstractions that you know, people read this for the first time and they say, well, you know, how do people kill each other over this? Well, they didn't. They killed each other over the concept of culture and human freedom. Bureaucracy, liturgy, use these words in the same way. They're not just, you know, ritual motions. They're not just a set of shared meanings. They're a mentality. They're an entire world. So you say, you know, someone like translates a word like sobor as counsel. You know, it's a real problem to do that. I mean, I understand why you would do it. It would take pages to explain yourself. You want to just use it for simplicity's sake, but that's really all you can do. But it's a terrible way to describe it, because we think of counsel, we think of people getting together and compromising and coming to some conclusion. That's not what's happening here. The Trinity is the only reality. Father, Son, and Spirit, again, using these in a broad sense. The Trinity is always reproduced in the family, reproduced in the synod. When we pray, we do what we're supposed to do. This is the Trinity. The Holy Spirit is working with us. We may freely choose to get the ball rolling, but after that, grace is taken care of. We become part of the Trinitarian life in that sense. We're not just autonomous human beings. We're part of this far larger cosmic divine order. We're ordered with a divine purpose, or a divine origin. Not just isolated human beings, the people who are being animated by the Spirit, you know, grace, energy, light. We're talking about the work of the Holy Spirit. The Sobor in Russian is almost like the incarnation of the Holy Spirit. So Valentine says that the church is grace given visible form. Saying that we have a body and senses, we need to have visible reminders of things, is one thing. But to say that those visible reminders in and of themselves have value independent of everything else is false. everything can be distorted, no matter how good it is. Concept of the faith itself. Now, St. Valentine and others, you know, they're dealing with atheists all the time. Usually very crude, very arrogant. Urban Jews overwhelmingly in that period of time. Faith slowly lost its original meaning. Today, the word faith just means something that's irrational. I have no proof for something, therefore I have faith in it. I still believe it. That's certainly not the case. I mean, there's blind faith. But as so many other words that have lost all their original meaning, faith is one of these things. St. Valentine tries to restore the original idea as best he can. We mentioned the apophatic idea that words and phrases and gestures that we use to describe things do not come close to exhausting their reference. When we're talking about divinity, we're talking about truth. Words are just, these are just very, very imperfect symbols that we use for the sake of communication. The concept of faith that he uses is to understand that we talk about any truth. There is the wording that we use to describe it, and then a far larger reality that's not being or cannot be encapsulated by the word or the gesture. That's what faith is. And you see this elsewhere. The simpler concept is that we begin approaching the things that are unknown, but only from the point of view of that which is known. And then we could slowly but surely extrapolate as we deal with greater and greater levels of the spiritual life. This is what he's talking about with faith. This is why the worship of the canons as in and of themselves valuable, or the external structure of the church, or bishops as such, as if they are this caste of people, is such an error. Because the implication is that grace is somehow encapsulated by the bishop, for example, or that the liturgical truth is manifest in the liturgy itself. No, the overwhelming majority of this extraordinary truth that's being revealed is not encapsulated in words. This is why, again, we have pictorial arts. The icon can do things that expository prose cannot. And no matter how hard we try, only a small amount of that truth, that grace, will ever be manifest in such a way that we can communicate it to others. Concept of sin is connected to this. Concept of sin is essentially a lie. When you have a mentality that causes you to do the wrong thing, what's happening slowly but surely is that reality gets projected onto the world. You're not seeing the world as it is. Those who are mired in sin aren't in trouble because they're doing the wrong thing over and over again. We all do the wrong thing over. That's not the issue. The issue is that over time, they won't have any connection with actual reality. Everything will be nothing more than a projection of their particular passion, whatever it happens to be. And they will not see human beings in the natural order the way they're supposed to. They're not seeing what's actually there. They're seeing a very distorted image that their own sins and problems have imposed on. So the idea of sin, in a sense, we've mentioned it on this show before, the idea that sin isn't so much the act. The act is a manifestation of the sin. The sin is in our first order identity. This deep heart, as Govorota would say, who we are, what we've constructed our vision to be. That's where sin resides. It manifests itself in bad actions. Obviously, bad actions, everyone does. The greatest saints do it all the time. I mean, Seraphim Sarov said he's the worst of all sinners. Well, he wasn't lying. He just simply very sensitive to this. He's doing the wrong thing all the time in one form or another. That has nothing to do with his holiness, though. His holiness is in his first order organization of his own psyche, the soul, his own energy. Sin projects a new order onto the world. It's a demonic. We said, you know, one of the absolutely essential theological understandings to have, especially in this day and age, is that demons have no power. The only way that they can dominate us is if we give in and believe that the images that they show us are in fact reality. When you have a passion or this drive that you know is irrational, you have you create an image in your mind as the world's going to be like when you possess whatever it is you want. How satisfied I'm going to be, how happy I'm going to be, how powerful I'm going to be, how respected I'm going to be if I just have these things. The image is false, of course, and you're not the author of it, generally speaking. The image comes from elsewhere. It comes from your subconscious. It comes from a perverted idea of an archetype. It comes from demons. It comes from some half-digested concept that you heard somewhere. Ignatius Brancianinov says that demons reside in the subconscious. It's chaotic down there. Creation itself is denied in the act of sinning. Now, what I said before, that bureaucracy is a mentality. It operates in the same way. Everyone is seen as a standardized mass. Everyone is seen to have the same motivations. Because I operate solely from financial motives, therefore everybody operates that way, or something like that. The point of it all is that the Petrian Revolution destroyed Russia because, like any demonic institution, and it's demonic only in its Petrian sense, not in all of its senses, but is that it rules by false imagery. The bureaucratic idea creates a personality. It goes way beyond just offices and pens and paper. It creates a vision of mediocrity, going along to get along, conformism, not thinking too deeply about things, not wanting to reflect, it's too inconvenient. This is what we're talking about here. That also is then projected onto the world. And you see in mass society, in modernity, where human beings are seen only as voters or consumers, they're seen as abstractions. They're seen as masses. The idea of masses is only a modern concept. There's no such thing as medieval mass because a mass has no identity. A mass is just that. It's just a blob of things. Human beings that just are like a crowd in a stadium. Their voices just merge into one incomprehensible scream. Whereas the Middle Ages, everyone had a particular role and function, so there can't be masses. There's only masses when those things have been destroyed and everything is rendered abstract and quantitative. St. Valentin created an institution similar to what Nepulyev, in a previous lecture, created his own Fellowship of Labor. They understood that the socialist idea is true, just that it's originally a Christian idea and it's an idealistic idea. Labor is the foundation of things, whether it be peasantry or otherwise. The Marxists never believed this, you know, except on paper. But they did not believe that. Worker for them was not a worker in a factory. It was a party hack. It was a pseudo-intellectual. It was a Jacob Schiff, you know. It had nothing to do with worker in our sense of the term. Labor was anyone who did not live a parasitic existence. The synod that Peter created had been separated from the life of the common population. They were overworked. They had a very small staff. They received very little money. Remember, the church owned no property from Peter on up because it had all been nationalized. And then anything that, you know, the sale of candles and icons and things all went to the state. The state then gave the church back what it thought it needed. The church did not own property in the sense that we would use the word own today. They did not. They received it in trust from the state. Everything had been secularized in the 18th century. Let me pause here for a minute. Let's give a bit of background of the two people who we're talking about here. The priest Valentin Kintinsky was not a monastic. Well, he was a married priest, but he believed in the resuscitation of a lay monasticism. To a great extent, a Christian socialist in the way that Dostoevsky described himself, a deep devotee of the Ovtina idea. He died in exile under torture in 1928. Andrei became bishop of Ufa in southern Russia, and Vysotsky, as an old believer, he had come under the hierarchy that comes from St. Ambrose. The White Well, Belokranitsa hierarchy of Austria, Russo-Ukrainian region that the Old Believers found a hierarch in Bosnia, being kicked out of his see for not being a Simoniac, and he agreed to come into the Old Believer idea and to restore the hierarchy. That was quite legitimate. He was there was nothing wrong dogmatically or in any other way with the old rite, and as many know, the Catacomb Church and then the Synod Abroad lifted all the anathemas on the old rite, which were invalid to begin with. He died constantly under torture, in and out of prison. He was killed finally either in 1937 or 1944, depending on the account. But not only was he tortured in the normal way, but had scurvy, had numerous diseases that kind of imprisonment would cause. So these men were tortured to death. These are new martyrs, and both died of extreme torture, not merely just being shot or something like that. They died under horrible conditions. Anyway, Valentin and they have much in common. Ideologically, they're very similar men. And ultimately, Valentin's brother, the Fellowship of Labor, rejected capitalism and socialism, in the Marxist sense of the term, because it reduces man to a machine. That's precisely how they view the world. The natural order is this mechanistic thing that can be tinkered with and repaired and made better. Again, it's love rather than the wording of the canon. That's the only truth. Love is this faith. The faith is this extension of our consciousness into things that are not amenable to words, the things that we look upon in an icon or even in a painting, that which isn't commensurate with that kind of speaking. Majority of grace and God's presence is not translatable into words. They both had something else in common, and that is Russia was going to be resuscitated at the parish level. For both Andre and Valentin, the parish was the cell of the new society. It wasn't just a religious institution, but it was a economic one. It was a meeting center. It was the center of the commune. And the concept is that even economic life is sanctified when parish and the parish council and the parish priest and, to a lesser extent, the bishop are involved in its functioning. Now, don't get hung up when it comes to Andre in terms of any condemnations of him for St. Peter, Kratica, or vice versa. You can't be talking about any exacting use of the canons when communications have been broken down, where we had a situation that was totally unprecedented. Meeting was almost impossible. You never knew who was a plant and who wasn't. So you're not going to get canonical exactitude here, so don't ask for it. You're going to get a lot of misstatements and a lot of bad information. They may have condemned each other, not realizing that the information that they have is faulty, that they weren't able to just look this up during the Civil War. They had to go with who they could trust. So don't get hung up on these kind of divisions if they're irrelevant. The only thing that matters is the faith, especially under the extreme circumstances of the day. They saw the modern world as believing progress has no moral value, but only it's the continuing extension of mechanization into more and more areas of life. And like people like Skovoroda, the central idea of non-alienated labor is vocation. You have a drive for something. It's one of the keys to the Russian Orthodox idea in terms of economics and social life. Labor is not alienated if it comes from the heart, if this is what you are truly meant to do. It doesn't matter, you could be living in poverty and completely exploited. It doesn't matter because this is what you love and this is what you know needs to be done. Because of the rejection of the bureaucracy, they accepted some concept of the National Assembly. This was the white concept in 1919. This is what they, kept talking about, that Russia is going to be rebuilt, but we need this National Assembly, almost like a constitutional convention, rather than as a way to replace. So they're thinking of more in terms of the Zemensky Sobor, or the Council of the Land, bringing together Russia symbolically in one place, rather than a bureaucracy that represented nobody. Remember, in 1900, the bureaucracy was essentially the nobility, and they were deeply Masonic and overwhelmingly liberal in politics. They didn't believe that a monarch really existed. It had nothing to do with whether or not, you know, Alexander or Nicholas were holy men. They had no choice in the matter. They were as trapped by the bureaucratic system as anybody else. Significantly enough, they both also believed in the idea that bishops and priests need to be elected by the people. The old believers had always done this. This had been the ancient tradition. And in Russia, it was only the Petrine Revolution that stopped that. The brothers in a monastery elect the abbot. The parishioners elect the priest. The diocesan council elects the bishop. This has to be a ground-up phenomenon in the way that these people understand the Federation. The Fellowship of Labor is based on the idea that the parish is a fundamental cell. They get together and create intermediate institutions that then go all the way up to the National Assembly. It's a bottom-up idea. A truth doesn't mean anything unless it's apophatic in the way that we're talking about. Love is the only truth, but they mean that in a very technical sense of the word. Valentin wanted the state completely out of education. He did not trust the state at all. The Slavophiles were anarchists, were national anarchists, and so were both Valentin and Andrei. Now, by state, they're referring to bureaucracy. They're referring to administration, that somehow law isn't distorted when it's standardized and placed in the hands of administrators who probably don't understand it very much and really don't care. They're there for their own personal advancement. St. Valentin was a chaplain in the Volunteer Army, one of the more ideological of the white forces. They accepted the idea of basic civil liberties in the Western sense, labor government, local control, worker control, and the Fellowship of Labor, and everything that Andrei and Valentin were promoting. Labor has to be in control of capital, and not the other way around. Everything is elected. And the reason that it doesn't exist like this anymore is the belief that everything is mechanical and that the ego somehow is exempt from all that. The ego of the elite, anyway, is alone is free. Somehow, and by some mysterious process, it has freed itself from natural causation and causality. They also believed, now this is Andrei, I disagreed with this slightly, but they believed in a single unitary Russia, and yet Andrei was a supporter of ethnic decentralization. The Tartars and the Ukrainians had certainly a claim to a great degree of autonomy. Andrei complained that that you had bureaucrats at the local level who were demanding that recent converts amongst the Crimeans and Tartars speak Russian. And they were being very arrogant about it, and they were actually driving Tartars away from the faith. They liked it so long as it could be done in their language, but they were insisting on Russian books just because it was easier. And they actually destroyed parishes because of this demand. And it comes from a complete lack of understanding what's going on at the ground level. Again, this is what bureaucracy is. It's standardized, it's mediocre, it's severance. You're cut off from the world. St. Andrei, although a bishop unlike Valentin, saw a loose confederation of Slavic states. You see quite a bit in Drahmanov, for example. He is not a part of the white centralizing idea, the white armies in the Civil War. Both condemned Sergius and both the Living Church as well as Sergius's church as completely illegitimate. They were promoting the Soviet Union and therefore the destruction of the church. So it doesn't matter what else they do, they're completely illegitimate. And the fact that it was actually controversial, that whether or not a church that seeks to destroy the faith is in fact a legitimate church, developed in Russia at the time, really shows you how bad things had become in this country, in that country at the time. And you still have that. You know, Sergius is being defended on canonical grounds. Like, that makes any difference. They're seeking to liquidate the church, and they're talking about canons. What the heck do you need canons for if their agenda is clear? And they condemned the memory of the Catacomb Church. And one of the things that the Moscow Patriarchate did that's admirable is admit their role, admit their contempt for the new martyrs was false, and canonize them. Canonizing the royal family took a lot of guts on their part. They didn't want to do it. but it was a way to make peace. Grace won, not their self-interest. To have them do it was an olive branch, suggesting that there is some hope there. You can't make these churches just these satanic voids, because there's no way then they could ever be redeemed except by abandoning them. Of course not. There's miracles occurring in that church. The church isn't the bishops. The jurisdiction of the synod isn't the origin of grace. And these are just institutions of convenience. And again, like everything else, we're talking about a mentality. We're not talking about Moscow Patriarchate or Sergianism. We're not talking about a formal definition. We're talking about that mentality that says that we can conform to no matter what evil, so long as we're canonically correct. There are people out there now so stupid and so ignorant. They're going on the internet and talking that the canonicity is when you're recognized by the Patriarch of Antioch. And they think that this is serious. That recognition somehow now is a theological category. But it could only be where nominalism seems to rule. The mediocre mentality seems to rule everything. Andrei saw the Slavophiles, especially Komenko, as a central Russian figure. These were communitarians, agrarians, and they were anarchists. Aksakov and Samarin, these were open anarchists. Bakunin himself said that Samarin and Aksakov's contempt of the state rivals his own. The state being, of course, administration, bureaucracy. The crown, the state, administration, government, these are different things. We're talking about the state in the German sense of the word, you're talking about a constitution. The religious element is the monarch, which is not necessarily connected with any kind of administration, but it is a religious institution that's saturated in ritual and symbol in the true sense of the word. But Andrei saw the old believers, as I did many years ago, as the model. They created highly egalitarian, highly literate, extremely holy institutions under the harshest of conditions and wanted for nothing. If it weren't for old believer merchants, Jews would have dominated the merchant classes 100%. But the old believers did not believe in usury or profit, and anything that they made over and above their expenses was plowed right back into the community again. So in that sense, they had forgotten about their own interests, and he who forgets his own life will, for Christ's sake, will receive it again, and receive it 100-fold. By abandoning self-interest, they get what they need and more. This is essential to the idea of love and the apophatic idea that both Andrei and Valentin here are promoting. It has as many economic and political consequences as anything else. These aren't separate fields. The old beliefs show that this kind of egalitarian communitarianism is essentially Christian and Orthodox and creates happy, stable societies under the worst of conditions. Clearly, this is a model to follow, and a lot of the catacomb communities followed that, although they were less stable than some of the old believers. The Belkhanitsa is the main group that maintains the priesthood. The priestless argument never made any sense to me. God in his mercy is always going to manifest the sacraments. There's no reason to withdraw them except for sin, or at the very least, create conditions where the identical grace could come to the believer anyway, especially if things get very, very bad. And a lot of the priestless old believers actually are, they have no difficulty with the priesthood, they just don't know where to find them. Or they have a long tradition, like in the Russian North, where they don't see priests very often. So the community takes over. And under the Turks in the Balkans, the Slav and Serbian areas, it was the patriarch of the family that took over religious instruction, as rudimentary as it was. Despite the fact that it was born in suffering, this becomes these are the institutions, these are the manifestations of survival. This is the nation. These are the contours of the nation, how people respond to this kind of oppression and pain and dislocation. In the old believers' case, they created an entirely new way of life. A clean, literate, highly intelligent, sharp, egalitarian, and yet very prosperous, with a tremendous work effort. That what Peter and the standardization of the church and the state did starting roughly in 1700, 1701, when the patriarch was not replaced, died and was replaced, not replaced by anyone, except this institution under Peter's control, that everything there changed. And once that was done, the old believers were manifest and the true faith. Now again, the true faith is never institutional. The concept, though, is that that in their reaction and adjustment to the pain that they suffered, they resurrected and purified the concept of old Russia. Andrei, in particular, sees the old believers as manifesting the best of old Russian tradition, and they've proven the resilience of it, because without very much financially, these communities have survived all over the Russian wilderness. And as things get worse and worse for us, this model is going to be almost obligatory. And the catacomb church then began adopting what the old believers had done, and began adopting a way of life that was completely separate from institutions. Institutions, the cataphatic idea of constitutions and words and, you know, ideological slogans, that somehow is reality, is completely rejected. When the institutions are taken from you, the best in the faith comes forth. When the comforts of these institutions are gone and you're left with almost nothing, you then have to scramble to find how are we going to please God. And in that scramble, we have our ascetic life and salvation. This is what the old believers did. The level of prayer, because they're constantly compensating for the lack of institutions, or highly decentralized institutions. What they had to create at the local level, compensating for that at the local level, was a complete cancellation of alienation. Alienation is when we believe that we don't do anything of our own. We'll let someone else, the government will do it, or a policeman will do it, or a lawyer will do it. No, we do it ourselves. And that mentality is the opposite of alienation. And when institutions are taken from you in a revolutionary idea, the revolutionary conflagration in Russia, 1918, 1921, 22, they had to reorganize and reform. And what came out of it was a deeply purified, forgiven church that brought Russia out of its doldrums now into an era of prosperity as much as humanly possible today under Vladimir Putin. Remember, institutions, synods, these are not the reality. They are highly limited symbols of reality. Grace doesn't come from a bishop. Bishop himself is subject to it. God's presence is singular and is not created as the kind of that radical Episcopalian idea suggests. The mentality behind both Valentin Sintetsky and Andrei Bufa is a development of a decentralized Christian anarchism based to a great extent on the old believers, and a development of Dostoevsky's idea of Christian socialism, and these highly idealistic Christian communities centered around the parish, and the parish even being the manifestation of several extended families. This is how we rebuild wherever we might be, the monastic level, the hermitage and the skete being the center of a small community. This is where sanity can be maintained in an age of insanity. We're creating these islands of sanity in the age of savagery. And that's what we're doing. And both of these men were tortured to death as a result. Remember, these are true rebels, not people who are given foundation grants and are front page lauded in the New York Times like Bernie Sanders. Real rebels, true rebels, are rotting in prison. Thank you for listening. We'll talk to you next time.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalists with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.